bogged down by it that it's easy to deceive us these days by it. And it's easy to get so lost in protecting it that we don't see the real game in the what's going on in the right hand.
Our collective instinct is our future doom.
Yeah.
If you understand what I'm saying, I'm saying that black folks congregating in mutual self-defense is wrong. But doing that for somebody who ain't like about what we need is wrong.
I mean, you know, and I mean, it's just as simple as this. I'm sorry. These days, there are black folks with entirely different ideas than what our history entailed. And I, you know, we just have to be aware of that. And really just, I have nothing to say bad about the guy. I could just say that I don't really think the guy, I'm speaking of Obama, has my best interest.
Let's just conclude this conversation with these words. I don't know you. I don't know you. Thank you. But what's your name? I hope you call back again.
My name is Shell.
All right, Robert. Talk to you soon. Thank you. You were very insightful. This is Earthwatch on WBAI New York. You're on the air. Go ahead.
This is Earthwatch on WBAI New York.
Hey, are you there? Hello, hello. All right, you're on the air. Hey, it's you.
Hello, Robert.
Good morning. Hey.
Robert?
Yeah.
Yeah, good morning. My name is George. You know what bothers me the most is how they have hoodwinked Americans so badly. You know, the whole system with everything.
So I'm not that far off the ranch, right?
Oh, hell no, brother. Hell no. And I'm just so amazed at how stupid Americans really are. They're gullible. You know, I mean.
So you said you believe in democracy.
What democracy? If I'm afraid.
I don't. Listen carefully, my brother. I did not say democracy. I said mockracy.
Yes. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. I mean, they treat us like little kids, you know. They just
speaking of little kids. Let me be Bob Fassian. Speaking of little kids, this is WBAI in New York. Go ahead.
It's just like the things that they pull politically, financially, and we as, you know, just American citizens just sit back and take it. You know, where's the fire in anybody's stomach about just doing the right thing?
Uncle Weatherby, well, you know, we might be waking up. You know, there's going to be a big thing on the 10th anniversary of Obama's war, who put in twice as many troops as Bush in Afghanistan. I think it's October 6th. And people are going to go to Washington and do things other than BS.
Mm-hmm.
Keep listening. We'll talk more about that.
Oh, please, please, please do.
Okay.
You know, but just one quick little point.
Yeah.
Do you watch Al Jazeera or even the BBC or other news programs?
Well, Al Jazeera English is a partner of Pacifica.
But I'm saying, where's the truth in American journalism? There is no truth in it.
I'm a blind guy with a lantern, okay? Thank you for calling, brother.
Okay.
Call me Saturday. Jesus, everybody's calling. You're on the air. Hello.
Good morning, Robert.
Good morning. How are you?
The blind leading the blind?
The blind leading the blind. Hey, what's up?
Okay, that's good. I'll go with that. Robert, you're wonderful.
Oh, that's good enough. That's good enough. No further comments, Your Honor. Thank you. All right, you're on the air. Thank you. We're getting very jolly. Hey, you're on the air.
President Obama.
Yeah, that's right. You're on the air. You know, I'm reading a book, a comic book called Scout. It's about dumbass white men like that one we just called, who have no respect for the heritage of the suffering of the indigenous people of this continent. So, you know what? Bleep him. This is Earthwatch. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Well, I think we should all be having a massive tax revolt at this point. Because, you know, it's just obscene the way they've mismanaged the taxpayers' funds to work against the taxpayer. It's just become so blatantly overt, the oligarchical power in our face. I mean,
we're taxpayers versus tax murderers.
What choice do we have at this point? If we're going to do anything, that's the only real power that we have, unless we want to just get out there and be crazy and violent.
Well, you know that we're in an extra-constitutional zone with this president. Don't believe in the fundamental constitution. Refused to answer a direct and basic question about that in his press conference earlier today. Maybe we can hear that before we're out of here. He studied constitutional law, Obama did, in order to know best how to violate it.
Yeah, I'm really beginning to wonder who he is. And speaking as a white person who has no white guilt about the racial issues, I can just tell you that a lot of people voted for Barack Obama. Mainly, they didn't think too much about him because compared with, we were all like sort of hysterical with relief that we're finally getting a candidate that it was at least educated.
You know, so, I love where you're coming from, and I feel your pain and appreciate the reach you offer. You know what I mean? You know what I mean by that, right?
Yeah, I do. And I just want to add that for the sake of light, not heat, that white people, I think, felt safe voting for Obama because they don't really think he's a black man. They think he's a white man with black skin.
I know. You meant well, and you know what? Both of us got fooled. I voted for him. You know, I will confess to that.
The only reason I voted for him is because I wanted to vote for Dennis Kucinich, but
the system
was set up, and I could have had a little more strength and written him in, but I wanted to vote in the primary, and the way it was set up, you could have only written in the real candidate.
He's a good man. He's a constitutionalist, and God bless his objection to war powers. I hope that he... I do another show called 5 O'Clock Shadow, and the great legal scholar, Dr. Francis Boyle, was on, offering whatever legal guidance is needed to impeach the bleeper. Thank you for calling. Everybody's lighting up. I got to go fast, and I got more material. Thank you. Thank you so much.
God bless.
All right. See? Doesn't matter what costume you wear. You're on the air.
What are the optimal conditions for building a safe, efficient nuclear plant?
Orbit.
Orbit.
Because
elsewhere than Earth?
Yeah.
Oh. sky plant.
I got it in one.
All right.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. This is Earth. So funny. You're I'm sorry. Pardon me. This is Earthwatch, and you are on the air.
Hello, Robert.
I hope so. Well, hello. I hope you've been good. Yeah, hey.
Hello. Good evening. Good morning. I listen to a lot of different radio, from AM, right wing, to NPR, BAI. This week I heard Neil Conant on NPR's Talk of the Nation refer to Mr. Obama as an anti-war person.
No, say it ain't so. No,
oh, yeah.
Neil Conant,
yeah.
Listen to me. I started as an egg here. I was younger than Jim Freund when I came after Jim Freund. He lied. And I know who Neil Conant was. When I would go to those seminars from NPR,
uh-huh.
He was one of my teachers.
I'm sorry.
Neil would never say that.
Oh, yes, he did.
No.
Darling,
no.
I swear to God, I have it on tape. I got everything on tape.
Oh,
but
God.
I think a lot of people during the campaign...
Had he been rendered somewhere?
Who, Neil Conant?
Yeah, through extraordinary rendition, and they, used aggressive interrogation techniques.
Not to my knowledge.
Oh, come on.
I don't know. I don't remember.
I got to research this. Let's just say, I don't know. Neil,
Neil
he's
Conan,
one of my icons. I'll check this out. I don't want to say more anything bad about him until I find out.
No,
okay?
I'm not saying anything bad. I'm just saying to be aware that he referred to Mr. Obama as anti-war. It was on the show where he had
he
the
was
guy
my mentor. Wait, each time you say that, I got to say, he was my mentor.
Okay. But it's okay, Robert. You'll be okay. But he was on with the guy Rudin, who does the trivia about politics. So it was the day of that he had that man on.
I got a question. All right, who did the most invasion of Afghanistan?
Who did the most invasion?
Bush or Obama?
Who cares?
Well, it matters because Obama did twice as much as Bush.
Well, I'm prepared to believe that. But during the campaign,
if that's a fact, I'll believe it too. But it's actually a fact.
Yeah, I believe it. But people during the campaign neglected, I think, to listen to Mr. Obama very carefully. He at no time stated that the war was against international law or anything like that. He believed, along with Hillary Clinton, that it was being badly handled, which is a difference.
Yeah, it is true. That
you got to listen between the lines and the lies, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But you'll be okay, Robert.
Thank you.
Okay.
I need that.
All right, and maybe you can talk to Neil, set him straight. You know, maybe he just fell off a bike or something.
I will give him his proper due for being partly responsible for my madness.
But it's not a criticism of it. It's that we should be aware of how people speak, because maybe he believes it.
I must hear it in context. I'll be fair.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, we're not here to trash my
heroes.
No,
I'm not trashing him. I'm just saying, you know, I listen to him a lot.
Yeah. Okay, I will. But you know what? It turns out they have some show called something. But I wish I could hear it, but I'm busy doing a better show called 5 O'Clock Shadow.
Well, thank you. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Take care, Rob.
Okay.
And I enjoy 5
Thank
o'clock
you. Pardon my brashness, but we're up against the biggest.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. This is Earthwatch. You're on the air.
Yeah. Oh, what are you? Oh, what?
There you go, you little racist. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes. Long-time listener, first-time getting warned.
Uh-oh. I hope it's a good reason.
Oh, well, anyway, I just wanted to let you know, there's a lot of us black people out here who do not believe in what Obama was going to do and all the promises he made. In fact, I have to be totally honest, I don't vote for anyone. All of my friends, we don't vote for anyone because nothing is going to change. And that's because of our belief in the Bible. Jesus said you will always have your poor. So that means that no one is never going to change. But I listen to you all the time, and I like your show, and hope I get a chance to speak to you again. Bye-bye.
Oh, wait. You've read one good book. Can I recommend a second good book?
Okay.
Invisible Man.
Invisible Man?
My sister, you must read Invisible Man.
Okay. We'll see.
Do that. Call me back in 2 weeks.
Okay.
I respect the book you mentioned. But check out the book I mentioned, The Invisible Man, Ralph Ellison.
Will do.
All right. What's your name? My name's Robert.
My name is Virginia.
Virginia? Call me in 2 weeks, Virginia.
Okay.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, you're on the air. This is Earthwatch.
Hi.
Hey.
My name is Heinrich, and I'm calling from England. And as far as Obama's concerned...
My name is Rolf, and you can find me in Düsseldorf.
No.
Sorry,
no. Actually,
funny thing. Sorry about that.
That's
from the producers, you know.
No, I know. Actually, I was thinking about getting Rosetta Stone and learning German. It's a coincidence. But I think he's a lot like Bush. I was telling people this all the time. And I'm not a Democrat or Republican. I'm not a communist. I'm not a conservative. I'm not a progressive. I'm not into any of that baby boomer crap. But I didn't vote for him. I didn't vote for John McCain. And as far as the war is concerned, it is a stupid war. They're funding Israel. They got he invaded Libya along with Britain. He's in Afghanistan. He's still in Iraq. Hello. He also got withdrawals. What he withdraws? What 40?
I don't have to say hello. I can see the embassy from
the
satellite in orbit.
Now I'm talking to the people. And personally, I think we should withdraw the bases and withdraw all of those wars and put those troops on the Mexican and California and Arizona border. We do not belong in Afghanistan.
You know, I think that's a great idea. That would keep a lot of people from escaping America.
No,
Thank you so much.
What? Becoming third world shit.
Well, you see, I can't have you saying that. This is Earthwatch. You're on the air. Functionally speaking, we're getting, you know. You're on the air. Hello. Hey.
Hello.
Hello.
Oh, you said.
Yes, you, babe.
You said the Invisible Man.
Ralph Ellison. Hell yeah. Have you read it?
Ralph Ellison.
The Invisible Man. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
That's our Black History book report for next week or week after. All right.
Okay, teacher.
Oh, shut up. I'm the fool. You got me mixed up with somebody else.
This is about you'll never be a fool.
Speaking of which.
You'll never be a fool. A fool and his money is soon departed.
Well, that would be me.
No, my brother.
Thank you. What's your name, sir?
My name is the Prophet.
You're the Prophet. Okay, well, I'm the loss.
Bye, my brother.
Okay, I love you. Good night.
I love you too, my brother.
Okay. This is Earthwatch. We only have a little bit left, but I want you all to hear tonight some of the words of your brother love warmonger. This is Earthwatch on WBAI. I'm Robert Knight.
Chuck Todd.
Thank you, Mr. President. There have been a lot of questions about the constitutional interpretations of a few decisions you've made. So I just simply ask, do you believe the War Powers Act is constitutional? Do you believe that the debt limit is constitutional, the idea that Congress can do this? And do you believe that marriage is a civil right?
Well, that was a hodgepodge. We're going to assign you to the Supreme Court, man. I'm not a Supreme Court justice, so I'm not going to put my constitutional law professor hat on here. Let me focus on initially the issue of Libya. I want to talk about the substance of Libya because there's been all kinds of noise about process and congressional consultation and so forth. Let's talk about concretely what's happened. Muammar Gaddafi, who prior to Osama bin Laden was responsible for more American deaths than just about anybody on the planet, was threatening to massacre his people. And as part of an international coalition under a UN mandate that is almost unprecedented, we went in and took out air defense systems so that an international coalition could provide a no-fly zone, could provide humanitarian protection to the people on the ground. I spoke to the American people about what we would do. I said there would be no troops on the ground. I said that we would not be carrying the lion's share of this operation, but as members of NATO, we would be supportive of it because it's in our national security interests and also because it's the right thing to do. We have done exactly what I said we would do. We have not put any boots on the ground, and our allies, who historically we've complained aren't willing to carry enough of the load when it comes to NATO operations, have carried a big load when it comes to these NATO operations, and as a consequence, we've protected thousands of people in Libya. We have not seen a single U.S. casualty. There's no risks of additional escalation. This operation is limited in time and in scope. So I said to the American people, here's our narrow mission. We have carried out that narrow mission in exemplary fashion. And throughout this process, we consulted with Congress. We've had 10 hearings on it. We've sent reams of information about what the operations are. I've had all the members of Congress over to talk about it. So a lot of this fuss is politics. And if you look substantively, at what we've done. We have done exactly what we said to do under a UN mandate, and we have protected thousands of lives in the process. And as a consequence, a guy who was a state sponsor of terrorist operations against the United States of America is pinned down, and the noose is tightening around him. Now, when you look at the history of the War Powers Resolution, it came up after the Vietnam War, in which we had 500,000 soldiers there, tens of thousands of lives lost, hundreds of billions of dollars spent. And Congress said, you know what, we don't want something like that happening again. So if you're going to start getting us into those kinds of commitments, you've got to consult with Congress beforehand. And I think that such consultation is entirely appropriate. But do I think that our actions in any way violate the War Powers Resolution? The answer is no. So I don't even have to get to the constitutional question. There may be a time in which there was a serious question as to whether or not the War Powers Resolution Act was constitutional. I don't have to get to the question. We have engaged in a limited operation to help a lot of people against one of the worst tyrants in the world, somebody who nobody should want to defend. And we should be sending out a unified message to this guy that he should step down and give his people a fair chance to live their lives without fear. And this suddenly becomes the cause célèbre for some folks in Congress? Come on. So you had what, a three-parter? What are the other two? I'm just saying I don't have to reach it. That's a good legal answer.
I beg your pardon, sir.
Let me start by saying that this administration, under my direction, has consistently said we cannot discriminate as a country against people on the basis of sexual orientation. And we have done more in the 2.5 years that I've been in here than the previous 43 presidents to uphold that principle.
So do you support it? Whether
it's ending Don't Ask, Don't Tell, making sure that
gay
and lesbian partners
you could have done
can
that
visit each other
by
in hospitals,
signing an executive order,
making
and
sure that federal benefits can
am I the only
be provided
crazy
to
here?
Same-sex couples.
Oh, wait. I'm
across
a Greek,
the board, hate crimes. We have made sure that that is a central principle of this administration, because I think it's a central principle of America.
Now, I'm trying to show him the respect he deserves.
Now, what we've also done is we've said that DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, is unconstitutional. And so we've said we cannot defend the federal government poking its nose into what states are doing and putting the thumb on the scale against same-sex couples. What I've seen happen over the last several years and what happened in New York last week, I think was a good thing. Because what you saw was the people of New York having a debate, talking through these issues. It was contentious, it was emotional, but ultimately they made a decision to recognize civil marriages. And I think that's exactly how things should work. I think it is important for us to work through these issues, because each community is going to be different and each state is going to be different, to work through them. In the meantime, we filed briefs before the Supreme Court that say we think that any discrimination against gays, lesbians, transgenders is subject to heightened scrutiny.
So, Mr. President, do you support gay rights or not?
So I think the combination of what states are doing, what the courts are doing, the actions that we're taking administratively, all are how the process should work.
Okay. President Obama, stating that he was in college at the time, and plus he was drunk. He doesn't remember it, and he has no need to compensate for things he might not remember. This is Earth Watch. I'm Robert Knight. I mean, you know, there is a limit. Yes, Gavul. Okay. I never thought a black president would ever make me feel like a black Supreme Court judge. But you know what? I never thought I'd quote Clarence Thomas, but I've heard enough lies. That's Barack Obama justifying his $5 trillion wars around the world today. That's your president, baby. And this is Earthwatch, and you're on the air. Hello. Hey.
Hi. I have a friend in Japan I sent this call to, and he replied immediately, and I would like to read this letter to you.
Please, let's share. Let's help.
You
got about 2 minutes to read it, so count that in. Okay, bye.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Please say, save the children of Fukushima for me. The U.S. government is trying to save their profit margin from sustaining nuclear expansionism in Japan. IAEA is a bunch of fucking assholes.
All right, you can't be that explicit, usually, except for accidental expletives.
Trying to misinform the world about what is really happening here. The fear of radiation is tearing our world apart. I have been part of the struggle for the past 3 months, and now my partner is in detention for making anti-nuke stickers, and my friends, and kids are forced to abandon their future plans and move down south away from high radiation levels. Millions of children have been exposed to very high doses, and it is continuing. No one knows when it will come to an end. Millions of us have our lives in turmoil, and they still want to choose some more money from their bad investments. They say that the investment in nuclear energy is just too immense, that if we abandon it now, the country will sink and be sold away to foreign powers. This situation is critical to the entire world. International communities have to question the validity of claims made by IAEA and realize that if Rocca Shomura and Monju goes with another earthquake, it could become a genocide of such scale that this world has never seen. The contamination will be absolute. No human technologies will be able to clean it up for centuries to come. Anyway, I have been going up to Fukushima, making fun outdoor events for kids. The radiation levels are so high up there, kids can't play outdoors.
I thank you for that beautiful reading. That's as much as we have time for tonight on Earth Watch. Thank you for speaking. This is Earth Watch. My name is Robert Knight. You tuned to WBAI in New York, a listener-sponsored radio station of the Pacifica Network. And one final announcement, an emergency call and call to crawl. For nuke zombies and nuke vampires to gather on the 4th of July on the sites of symbolic explosions to reveal the effects continued reliance on nuclear power will have on the human populace of planet Earth. As things stand today, we are zombies to the future, a living dead. As the time bomb of half lives tolls an eternity, we must avoid at all costs. July 4th, New York City, West 25th Street and 10th Avenue. Follow below Highline Park or wherever you or your group decides. Further info will be, I guess, engaging in what will eventually be characterized as a conspiracy for peace. Thank you so much for listening tonight here on Earthwatch on WBAI. And please continue to support us, and hopefully we'll be back next week. and daily Monday through Thursday, except for Mondays during the Another Fracking Monday series. Great work being done by Rebecca Miles here on the new WBAI, doing our job for everybody like we're supposed to. Thank you for listening. This has been Earthwatch. If you want to communicate, I'm R Knight, R-K-N-I-G-H-T, at WBAI.org. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for a brilliant show with Jim Freund, Hour of the Wolf, following this.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Wednesday night program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund, depending on Saturdays or Wednesdays. With me this morning, Terrence Taylor and apparently Ken Gale. And we have a very, very specific topic to discuss this morning. And we'll tell you what it is after we're off the air. Stay tuned. Good morning. Well, I mean, even the people in this room have no idea what it is that I said. So, because I said, and I knew what I said, and I meant what I said, what I meant, and I meant what I said. And Elephants Faithful, 100%. Thank you very much. Okay, so at least we're all on topic. We're all on, you know, on that. Okay, I know you're, well, you may be, but until I turn the mic on, it's moot whether you're on mic.
Just testing.
Yeah, I think try say just testing again.
Just testing.
Yes, now you're on mic. Okay. Mwah. So, this is what we call a free form show, and you're not going to find them freer and less formy. than what we're discussing here. But first, let me make a couple of announcements. Announcement number one is when I had Rick Bowes last week on this program, I said that Paul Witkover would be here this week. But Paul has had personal issues in his life that he had to deal with. Traveled to Ohio, got back today. Paul is a huge Green Lantern fan, and this was something that we were thinking of discussing, except I'm only interested in discussing that with him to a certain extent because he's a fine, fine writer in his own right. And so I didn't want to take – he hasn't been on Hour of the Wolf in about 3-4 years, and I want him to discuss his own writing. He's got any number of books out. He's an internet pioneer. He started a company called iPublish maybe 20 years ago, which is a big, big deal that went absolutely nowhere because people didn't have the foresight to understand the concept of publishing on demand, which is something that he sort of pioneered and things like that. So he continues, you know, being a fine writer, doing some work for hire, working as a co-editor and reader with Ellen Datlow, and he's a former curator of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, right, which he ran for 2 years, and so on and so forth. So Paul, at any rate, is not on this week because I have this week and next week, and I knew that we were coming up to a thon. So I didn't schedule anybody for the first week in July. It turns out that the first week in July, I don't have an agenda. So I invited Paul, I disinvited him. I gave him the opportunity to say, breathe. Just breathe. You know, you're done. Right now, he's done dealing with family matters. When he wrote me this afternoon, he was in Ohio. You know, and would have gotten back, tried to see this movie to discuss, and then been on the air at 1:30. And I thought, you know what?
Kind of pushing it.
that he might be a little stressed after that, so better off. So I rescheduled that, and then I was preparing various things, and I thought I should ask Terrence Taylor.
Wow.
Who, simply because we were talking about...
We were.
About your simply coming back and doing a show without a specific agenda. And then who should be here but Ken Gale, who I wanted to actually host one of the programs, except when I asked you to do that, I did not realize in my dumb little head that it was in the middle of the thon, and you're right. I may just be scheduled to be a Gary Null rebroadcast. I do not know what's
going on. You've got to find out, yes.
If that is not the case, if I am scheduled to be on, that is your show. That week I will be at ReaderCon,
uh-huh,
which is the one convention of the year that I always try to
I thought make. ReaderCon was on a weekend.
Yes, but we go up early. It starts on Thursday.
Huh? Yeah.
Programming is on Thursday, and I actually have one panel that I'm moderating on Thursday, and Barbara's on a panel on Thursday, and she's doing a reading on Friday, and there's radio drama that we're actually working on, yeah, that's on Friday, Tempest Bradford's Until Forgiveness Comes, and in the cast are myself, Ellen Kushner, Pan Morrigan, Andrea Hairston, and Mary Robinette Kowal.
Sounds like a very fun group.
Yeah, it's a fun group, and it's mostly, myself excluded, a very, very professional group. So we'll be doing that. And that's a dry run for radio drama that we're actually going to be doing a studio production of here in August, hopefully for broadcast September 11th,
lovely,
because it has themes, along with Rick Bowes' story,
10th anniversary.
10th anniversary, there's a hole in the city. Pacifica Radio is going to, of course, be taking the day.
Oh, we think so.
And is the intent of the program director to say, excuse me, but WBAI is like five blocks from Ground Zero.
Yeah, yeah.
So we intend to be doing a lot of the network programming at that point, and I am asking for an hour of that time. I don't know that I'll get a minute of it, but I'm asking for an hour. I did get the 5th anniversary.
Oh.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping to get, with Rick Bowes, as a matter of fact, because that story of his, There's a Hole in the City, is, which, by the way, is available for free online. If anybody wants to Google up Richard Bowes, or I think if you just go to Rick Bowes, RickBowes.com.
To his site.
There will be a link to the story on his site, but listen to him read it. It's brilliantly edited, and he does a good reading as well. But at any rate, so that explains this week's show, and potentially the one in the middle of June that, with any luck, Ken Gale will be hosting.
Who knows?
Ken did a show on BAI called Nuff Said about comics that sort of began as a result of his sub-hosting. And
I would say even more than sort of.
Okay. Where his first guest, you know, starting at the bottom, he started with Jim Shooter. You know, it's like, okay, go to the pinnacle of the industry.
Yeah, somebody who ran Marvel Comics, has been writing comics since he was 13 years old, and started, at the time, two companies, and now three. And of course is a very controversial figure as well.
Oh, well, tell me about three people, tell me about one person in the industry who isn't.
Gene Colan.
Hmm.
Gene Colan is not controversial. Everybody loves Gene
Colan. I dispute that. But anyway, okay.
Gene Colan, he died last Wednesday.
Oh, my God. That's really? Right. I forgot that. That's right. I saw the listing. I was heartbroken.
Yeah, every time you go to SFFNet, there's a little rose with somebody's name on it. It gets real depressing.
Yeah, I know, yeah. It's like we're watching an entire generation of everything slipping away.
Yeah.
But I remember, like, one of the things I liked about the first Blade movie was that it the cinematography so looked like Colin's drawings for Tomb of Dracula.
Yeah, they did.
I mean, they had this wonderful use of shadow. And
they even
color.
Gave him a screen credit.
Did they? I wonder if
pull
he was
the mic
involved.
Closer to you, Terrence.
Oh, there we go. I was wondering if he was involved because I mean, it looked so Colin.
Well, no, he didn't. He got screen credit for co-creating the.
Oh, for creating Blade. Sure, for, sure. Yeah. I had that comic in one of.
Well, it's nice that they gave him at least screen credit.
Yeah,
for that.
Well, and it was a weird lawsuit because Marv Wolfman and Gene sued Marvel to get the rights of the character back, or to get a piece of it, and of course Marvel fought them on it. And in court, Marvel said, "We have lost all our paperwork. We have no paperwork to prove our contentions."
Ooh!
And they won anyway.
Huh. Yeah,
they won anyway.
The whole concept of work for hire.
Well.
Which you've done, Terrence, you've done a lot of work for hire.
Pretty much everything. I mean, anything that's not my own material has been worked
for hire. Yeah, but I mean, but people who are doing stuff who is their own material, simply if they didn't create the premise, and even then if they create the characters, like Chris Claremont. Chris must have created a number of characters that are in X-Men,
sure.
Right?
Yeah. Sure.
But if you're on staff,
who created
if you're on
Wolverine?
Salary, they just take it away.
Wolverine was, what was that?
Is that Stan or
Len
is that Chris?
Wein and George Tuska, I think it was.
Ah, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. But they don't have a piece of it.
Oh, no. No.
Not
Dave
at all.
Dave Cockrum created Storm. Didn't get a piece.
Right.
Yeah, he created Nightcrawler. Basically.
Yeah, but you know that any character in X-Men that's named after a band member of Steel Eye Span, such as Dazzler, which is Madeline Pryor,
okay.
All of Steel Eye Span are in X-Men, may I point out.
The actual band's members' names?
Yes.
Yes.
Because Chris Claremont is a huge Steel Eye Span fan.
Really
you know, being in the same circle with people like Margot Adler and
people in the room.
People who a lot of former BAI people, some of whom are now NPR people and all that.
Right.
Are huge Steel Eye Span fans, and it's within a circle. And so Chris, of course, was what in fandom they call Tuckerizing.
There we go. Sure. Exactly.
And so any number of various characters, most notably Dazzler, Madeline Pryor, Maddie Pryor of Steel Eye Span. There's also Peter Knight, and there's also all the various band members of that era found their way. Small time or big time. If Bob Fass can make it into Wonder Woman, which you, Ken, said was Denny O'Neill,
Denny
would
O'Neill
probably done that.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, we're already into the show. I need to make an announcement.
To
announce something. It was easy when Hour of the Wolf was on Saturdays because I would be promoting an event the following Tuesday. And that would be within the memory of listeners.
There
but now, on Wednesday night, Thursday mornings, I have to promote something about the next Wednesdays. And frankly, I really don't like doing what we're doing here and descending to this thing about comics. But I do the highbrow stuff.
New Yorkers are busy, so giving them a week's
and
notice is better than giving them
the
a few days' thing. Notice.
Okay, so because I curate the New York Review of Science, I produce and curate the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. We stay highbrow. So this coming Tuesday, we're doing all comic books. let's see if you know the names, Ken, because it's all sort of modern, interesting stuff. First of all, our guest curator is Gina Galliano, and she is, people will notice her at all readings that she attends because she's 6 feet tall.
And a lovely
young, lovely person and very unassuming. When I ask her for a good bio, she gives me one line.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, give me more than that. She says, well, I'm not very interesting. This is untrue. Listeners,
this is untrue.
This is totally, totally untrue. She slanders herself.
It's the modesty of the fascinating.
Because what has she, aside from being an editor at Macmillan, First Second Books, which does some very interesting graphic novels, although neither of these people that she has booked are her own. She doesn't edit either of them. She edits some very interesting stuff. The readers will be Dave Roman and Molly Crabapple. Mm-hmm. Now, at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, on the floor where we always hold the readings, we have these digital screens. You've been there, each of you. Yeah, Terrence has read there. Ken has attended twice.
I've been on one of those.
At least you were there for the Nebula Awards thing and for the Carol M. Schwiller event.
Right.
Right. And you have these screens around the room where we can show anything on these large high-def screens. But we're going to hold the event downstairs. This is a first for us.
Oh.
Common for them. Common for the gallery, but first for us downstairs is a whole other area, which includes a big movie size screen. And what we're going to do is we're going to have we're going to have animations and stills of comic stories with the author of those comic stories doing the voices.
Yeah.
And this is actually not a first for us because, it is for NYRSF, the New York Review of Science Fiction, but I did a cartoon concert at WBAI in about 1976 in Studio C of what was the church. We owned a church at the time.
I remember it well.
And the person who did the animation and the drawing was Von Bode.
Oh.
Now, there's a name that everybody in the room remembers.
76?
I'm not sure of the year.
Von Bode died in 75.
Well, then it was.
I'm not going to say that you didn't have Von Bode after he died. I suppose if anybody's going to come back.
It would have been about 2 years before he died. Hmm. So you're saying it was more like 73?
Yeah,
really?
I guess.
Wow.
God.
I guess. All I
remember his last con and his last drawing.
Was that in Toronto?
It was a Phil Sewing July con.
Uh-huh.
Here in New York City. I believe it was at the Commodore.
The Commodore?
Yeah, on 42nd Street. Now
huge
a Hilton
place
or something.
Yeah.
And
horrible hotel.
He auctioned
all cons
off,
were at the Commodore or the Statler Hilton.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Yeah. He auctioned off, quote, an hour of his time, unquote.
Wow.
And,
oh, that's cool.
Yes. And the auction went up to $450, which 1975 was real money.
It's not bad now.
Yeah.
I'll take it.
And
still buy equipment.
And so they had him do a drawing. Well, he worked on this drawing for over 24 hours.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Did not sleep.
God.
They would come and bring him food every once in a while. And Phil had set aside an area of the convention where he did this drawing. And it became sort of an event of the convention. Is go check out, you know, what the drawing looks like since you last looked at it.
Durational art.
There was a
today you'd put it on a webcam.
Oh, right. It'd be a happening in the past. You know,
in those days, everybody went to the panels. Uh-huh. And nowadays, not so much, except for San Diego.
Well, it depends. I mean, there's two ways of handling panels. One is to look at the program book and say, do they really expect us to sit through all this bleep? And the second way to handle the panels is to look at the program book and say, look at all this great bleep we're missing. That's always been my philosophy.
There you would have thousands of people go, and the bigger stars, the dealers' room went empty.
Yeah.
And the dealers didn't mind because they got a little bit of a rest.
They
knew
the
that these people would come back.
Right,
in other words, they were there all day because they went to the panels and went to the dealers room, went to the panels, went to the dealers room. So they were there all day instead of going and make the round of the dealers room and leave, like at so many conventions now. And so the room next to the panel room was where Von Bode was doing this drawing. And if you've seen the drawing of the Lizard of Oz.
Oh, God.
That's the drawing.
Oh, my God. I remember that.
And that's the last
thing
he did.
I remember the title. I don't remember the drawing.
It was The Wizard of Oz with all his characters.
With the Cheech Wizard not the Junk Waffle characters.
No, right.
But all the Cheech Wizard characters.
Yeah, exactly.
I think a lot of people listening today don't know who Von Bode is, and I think that they don't.
Absolutely.
When
he died, he was one of the most counterfeited artists around.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because it was relatively easy to mimic his style.
Oh, yeah.
And there's at least one full-length movie that emulates his work.
That's a
I'm being very
story.
Careful. I'm very careful with my language here.
But so many people counterfeited Von Bode artwork after he died, that Von Bode artwork became worthless. Literally. Yeah.
And you know what?
Because not enough people could tell the real from the fake.
I owned or own, if I can find it, a certain amount of original Von Bode work. Because Frank Heller of WBAI in those days was himself he was a crusty bunker, which meant that he did, you know, bleep work for Neil Adams and
Frank Heller and Frank Crusty Heller. Bunker. I don't remember
Frank
seeing him in the gang. I used to hang out at Continuity back then.
I don't know all the details, but he was the one who brought me Neil Adams, which in turn got Neil to offer the Warp posters on the air, which in turn apparently brought Robert Knight to the WBAI to get a Warp poster, as a matter of fact. Those are Subway posters. Those are fabulous. And, and there are people who say that George Lucas took work, people being Terrence.
Just saying, every time I look at the poster, I see characters that seem amazingly analogous.
Okay, except that
I don't have the Subway poster. I just have the theatrical one.
So not everybody knows who Warp is either.
Well, no. But a three-part science fiction action adventure with an evil empire.
But Warp was this amazing. Today it would run forever.
Yeah.
And it ran well in Chicago. When it came to Broadway, Warp was basically a comic book on Broadway.
I know, and it was
great. Yeah, in Chicago it ran well but it over closed a year, after the first maybe 2 years.
More like 2 years, and it was a trilogy, and all three shows ran well. Only part one opened on Broadway. It ran shorter than the original Rocky Horror Show, which was another huge flop with Tim Curry, you know, and it just down.
Yeah.
And so anyway, through Frank Heller, I got in touch with Neil Adams and Von Bode. And Von also got in touch with us. He was very outgoing and very strange, interesting character. And I remember very well waiting for 5 a.m. to roll around for Hour of the Wolf, and Heller and I sitting nearby the Silver Star, a greasy spoon that is still a diner, I should say, that is still it's about 65th or 66th Street and 2nd Avenue. And the moment Heller would walk into any kind of local place, he would take the mats that they had with the martinis and the cocktails on one side, turn it over, and began drawing.
Yeah.
And he did that immediately, and so did Bode.
Yeah.
A lot of artists do that.
And we're sitting there, we're eating, and Vaughn was drawing this stuff, and every time he filled one up, I took it. And I got two. And I got two of these filled with little sketches and stuff like that of original Vaughn Bode work. And about two or three years later, the guy asphyxiated himself in what should now be called the Bode Carradine style. Vaughn was
in excess. Michael Hutchins. There's a long list.
There really is. There should be.
We could do a wall of fame.
Oh my God, a wall and of flame, wall a, be- of, wall a belt of fame, a belt, a belt of fame.
And Vaughn's son Mark is carrying on his dad's characters and doing cartoon concerts.
Huh. Is he doing the concerts?
Yeah, he's doing them. He's living in San Francisco now.
One of the very first cartoon concerts ever was at WBAI Studio C, which I produced. And we announced it. We were promoting it left and right. And I'd say that we got... There must have been 8 people showed up for this.
It was a huge success. Now, what was the nature cartoon concert on the radio?
What he did was it was already established stuff, and we put it onto a overhead projector. We'd put that there, and Vaughn, with his microphone, would do all the voices.
Yeah.
And to come full
Sewing conventions, it was the most popular item there. Unless Stan Lee or Jack Kirby was giving a talk, Vaughn's cartoon concert was the most popular event.
They were wonderful. I don't know how early it was at that point, but he was fully set with it. So I guess he must have done it several times before when he did it at BAI, but he did it for us. And it was a lovely thing, and he was really wonderful to work with. He was this neat guy who, yes, he knew his own value. He knew his place in pop culture and all that. Oh, I remember where Heller knew him from. Both of them worked for Mattie Simmons. National Lampoon. Yes. Where Heller was both a recording engineer on such albums as That's Not Radio Funny, Dinner, That's Sick, and Radio and Dinner. But Heller's also an artist. And so, you know, in those days, if you were a certain kind of commercial counterculture, you may very well be doing work for Mattie Simmons. And wasn't some of Von Bode's work coming through some Mattie Simmons magazines? He had several magazines in those days.
Well, I mean, Von Bode was all over the place. I mean, he was quite prolific.
Yeah, there was Junk Waffle, and there Junk and Waffle Cheech was my comics.
Cheech was an American. But he did stuff
for Cavalier, which was a what they call a men's magazine.
A girly magazine, actually. Yeah, men and your girlies.
Yes. And
the Supreme Court called it a girly magazine.
And in fact, in it must be a lot of the cartoon concerts were Cavalier cartoons. So what he would do them is you have the artwork and then dialogue above them, so it would be easy to do a slide of the artwork without the word balloon.
Well, I think the phrase a cartoon concert is something that Vaughn really, you know, branded.
I know, he coined the word. I mean,
yeah, he certainly coined it and branded it. Well, we're doing...
And I had Mark Bode on Nuff Said.
Did you?
And he brought tape of his dad doing a cartoon concert.
Well, I have
the first dead guest I ever had on Nuff Said.
I have the reel-to-reel tapes of the ones that he did for BAI. God knows what condition they're in, but I need to convert those to MP3. I don't have the artwork. Maybe Mark Bode does, but I have the tapes.
Well,
and
Mark
has
a lot of.
Might be able to use extra audio.
Sure. Yeah, exactly.
He could probably use, because I don't know how many of those were recorded. I recorded the whole thing on 15 inches per second reel to reel. Okay, that's on three reels for the whole thing, and I actually have a vague idea where they are, which is unusual for me. I labeled those. So anyway, and Vaughn drew on the box of one. Some years later,
a person
who I will not name, a rather well-known artist himself, contacted me and said, I understand you have original Vaughn Bode artwork. Because I've told this story before, and I said, I suppose I do somewhere. And it's like, you don't know where you have it? It's Von Bode artwork. Are you sure it's original?
It seemed to be when he drew it.
You know, I sat in a restaurant with him.
And watched him.
And he drew. And this person challenged me and called me a liar. You know, and I said that I had to find it and show it. And then this person would judge.
If it was authentic
this
or not.
This was about
the arbiter.
This is about 4 years ago. About 4 years ago,
Bode Finder General.
It was somebody who was working on a book. Mm. And somebody whose name I knew and respected.
Until that call.
Yeah. So, which is why I'm not naming the name.
Yeah.
I will tell you off the air, because I know it's somebody you probably know.
Oh, you could tell them with the theme of the show.
Yeah, exactly. when we tell everybody later on what kind
after
of show
we get off
doing.
The air, what we're doing.
So, anyway... On this coming Tuesday, we're doing a cartoon concert, to use Von Bode's word for it. And Gina Galliano's putting this together. She wrote me with the move of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings to the Soho Gallery for Digital Art. We're introducing the occasional graphic novel reading, as we now have the opportunity to see the reading as well as hear it, essential for science fiction fantasy works in the comic form. Mm. I say hear, which is why Gina approached me with this. And I said, absolutely, I told her about the Von Bode things. But at any rate... So what does she do? She comes up with these amazing names. Now, these are not people who I knew directly. But this is why I love using guest curators. Terrence Taylor here with me, guest curated one. We're going to have to do another.
Yes, we must.
Last October, people. You did all a four black vampire writers.
It was a great fun evening. We had a lovely time.
Yeah. And you're going to do another one this year, though we know not yet what.
We don't know what.
But I'm going to do Vampires in October again, but this will be with Clay and Susan Griffiths.
It's a good cover.
And the host will be some woman named Adler, Margot. Yeah,
you know, she's just starting out in the business.
She created a radio show called Hour of the Wolf in 1972, and now she slums at NPR.
No good could come of it.
Exactly the phrase. And she's actually, if you go to NPR.org and look up Margot Adler, you will hear the three pieces on vampire fiction that she has already done.
Oh, I think I've seen
She those. Loved Bite Mark. She loved your second book.
I loved her analysis.
Did you read the second one?
Society and the way vampires are portrayed. I thought that was wonderful.
Well, she's doing a whole book.
Yeah.
She has gotten a contract.
Oh, she did? Oh, great. Oh.
She succeeded. Lovely.
She's I remember when she was shopping it around. She's gotten her contract
for doing an entire book about vampire lore and fiction and subculture in America today. It's and the way Margot writes, the way she wrote about witchcraft in the late 70s.
Every vampire movie or TV show I've seen since Margot talked about vampires and what goes on in society on your show through history, I have done it with like her in the background, and it all fits. You know, the whole thing about, oh, we're pretending vampires are good guys just as we're pretending we're good guys when we invade other people's countries.
There we go, yeah.
And then I'm watching a Swedish vampire movie. Well, of course, Sweden's not invading other people's countries. And that is not the theme of Let the Right One In at all.
Although, you know, there's another Swedish vampire film that nobody takes into account. They all say Let the Right One In is the first
Cold
major.
Cold Dryer?
No.
Cold Dryer, no.
No.
The first major what?
Swedish movie featuring vampires in a major theme.
I wouldn't know if that was the first or not.
No, I know of one made in 1968. The director was?
Roman Polanski, the fearless vampire killer.
He's not Swedish.
I know, I'm trying to guess. I'm trying desperately.
Ingmar Bergman.
Which one would you consider a vampire?
Hour of the Wolf!
Oh, yeah, I haven't seen it yet. It's on my Netflix stack. Now it's on Netflix again.
Is it?
Yeah, but I didn't watch it. I started watching it.
Hour of the Wolf is a film by Ingmar Bergman
about vampires?
Yes.
Well, I started watching it on air one night.
It's not a very watchable movie.
And it was 3 a.m.
I don't make claims for
being
a great movie,
and I fell asleep after 15 minutes.
It's really one of Bergman's weakest films. But Bergman's weakest films are better than most people's top films.
I would never disagree with such a
thing. Hour of the Wolf is about an artist played by Max von Sydow and his wife played by Liv Ullmann, who is having a creative crisis.
Right.
He moves to an island where Bergman did he did Persona and he did a couple of other films in that same era.
Yeah.
They're among his darkest films.
I know.
Virgin Spring notwithstanding. And this guy meets his own demons. Now, are they of his mind or is he of their mind? This is something that is not let onto, but there is a werewolf, there is a vampire, and there are some other occult creatures, including it's complicated, and whether they're real or not is moot. But there's no question that there is
a vampire
and a werewolf.
To see how he would deal with that subject matter.
Well, it's a fascinating film because, you know, what Bergman film isn't? This film is called Hour of the Wolf. Somebody by the name of Margot Adler saw that movie and decided to name a radio show after it.
And thus the...
And so did the Firesign Theater, which is why in Don't Crush That Dwarf, Hand Me the Pliers, there's two references. There's the Howl of the Wolf movie, and there's the Hour of the Wolf news.
Ah.
And what the Hour of the Wolf is, let's get this straight, gang. It's, according to Ingmar Bergman, the time between... Hold on just one second, listeners.
As he shows off his internet connection that I can't access with wireless.
Well, yeah, there you go.
The Hour of the Wolf is the hour between night and dawn. It is the hour when most people die, when sleep is deepest, when nightmares are most real. It is the hour when the sleepless are haunted by their deepest fear, when ghosts and demons are most powerful. The hour of the wolf is also the hour when most children are born.
Okay, you got that, everybody? Okay, that's the trailer of the movie, of course.
And that's why I sleep in, because I want to just avoid that hour completely.
Okay, so
I go to bed just before.
Yeah, so, well, if you're leaving here after the show, you'll be getting home about
I'll be going right to bed.
Joe Straczynski, author of some TV series called Babylon 5, the first episode of season 4 was called Hour of the Wolf.
Okay.
And he has Claudia Christian's character in there say, oh, the Hour of the Wolf is at 3 a.m. when everything's dark. And wrong! Wrong!
It's the hour before dawn. When the night is darkest.
And when I mentioned, and the thing is when I mentioned this once on the air.
I just love the voiceover.
Oh, yeah, it's a classic voiceover.
Oh, it's great.
It's 3 minutes long.
I want to put in a dance beat and, like, separate it out into, like,
the early crepuscular light.
There you go.
Crepuscular. That's a word you don't get to use all
that. So one time when I had Veronica Shaness on the program, and she, of course, teaches mythic lore and stuff like this, I explained that, and she said, oh, Vargtimen. Well, wolf time. It's an ancient Swedish myth. And by the way, when we talk about the Vargtimen.
Why does everything sound kind of funny when you say it in Swedish? Vargtimen. Even the darkest thing, Vargtimen.
Yeah, well, wolf time. And bear in mind, it all by the
sounds
way,
like
when they talk about the twilight
Mission Impossible
in
language.
Sweden,
yes,
Northern Sweden, twilight, and we're not talking that vampire thing.
With a V instead of a W?
Yeah, I don't know how you say it, but twilight, in the morning time, the time between between night and dawn.
And dawn.
That can be 2 hours long in Sweden.
Well, you're times that far of day, it could be 6 months long if you have the right time of year.
You know, for those people that know the Act Two opening scene from Little Night Music, the song that says, you know, 8 o'clock. Twilight. 9 o'clock.
Twilight.
10 o'clock.
Twilight.
Yeah.
That's funny. I never thought of it in those terms, though.
What it's about.
Sometimes when you see Sondheim in high school, you only get about a third of it.
Another Bergman film, of course. Little Night Music is based on a Bergman.
And I love Smiles of a Summer Night. I loved the musical. It's a lovely movie. It's a beautiful movie.
Yeah, it really is. So anyway, so that's where Hour of the Wolf comes from.
Beginning.
So. Pardon me. We're doing a cartoon concert.
Yeah. Well, we all have to talk to funny
Tuesday.
Voices that night.
Let me tell people. Molly Crabapple. Oh, my God. Look her up. Aside from her artwork, which is so bizarre. Molly Crabapple was an artist model and an artist herself.
Did she model for herself?
When, yes.
Drawing herself in a
mirror. Oh, yes. There, I have a little.
Oh, a little self drawing
of that
there.
Right
yeah,
here, as
yeah.
a matter of fact.
That's
as everybody on the radio can see. Molly Crabapple,
rub it on the microphone,
artist, comics creator, and entrepreneur. She's created this thing. I think it's called Mr. Sparky's, Mr. Sketchy's Salon, where people go in and you've heard of this. Yeah, that's her.
Okay.
You know, where people go and they sketch. I think they have to
live art.
They sketch live art and they have to imbibe first.
Oh,
and then
drunken sketching of naked models.
Well, that's exactly.
I'll bet she does well with that.
She's got it going in about four cities.
I'm thinking that could do
Europe.
Very well.
It's doing very well. Thank you.
There we go.
So this is one of our guests.
We love it.
One of our readers doing the cartoon concert. She's called A Downtown Phenomenon by the New York Times and The Artist of Our Time by Margaret Cho, using her hyper-detailed Victorian pen for graphic novels, giant nightclub murals, and for clients like DC Comics, Marvel Comics, South by Southwest, Red Bull. I refuse to say SXSW. It's South by Southwest, people. Red Bull and the Wall Street Journal. Molly is also the founder of Dr. Sketchy's Anti-Art School. He's had it right in front of me. An all-drawing salon with branches in 120 cities from Akron to Zagreb. I assume some of these are smaller than others, which Robert Ebert recently called inspired. Molly has spoken at the Museum of Modern Art, the Brooklyn Museum, and museums and universities from Helsinki to Sao Paulo. And so, you know, this is one of our, you know, Gina has really done nicely. Mm. Dave Roman is the other person. He has done comics about X-Men, and Avatar, The Last Airbender, as well as contributing to the Flight anthologies. I'm not sure what those are. And editing the video game comics anthology, Life Meter, the New York Times bestsellers.
He does some very interesting covers, too.
Yeah, okay. So you do know his work.
Oh, yeah, I know Dave Roman, yes.
Oh, okay. New York Times bestseller, is also the author of Agnes Quilt, an anthology of mystery. After working as the comics editor for Nickelodeon magazine, you worked for Nickelodeon, didn't you, Terrence?
Yeah, at the beginning, before the accountants took over.
For 10 years.
Mm. When it was still fun.
His first solo project, Astronaut Academy, came out in June from First Second Books. Oh, that is where Gina is, so there is a connection. The Comics Waiting Room says of it, there will not be a better all-ages graphic novel published this year than Astronaut Academy, period. I'm glad they punctuate well. I might have said full stop. Finally, I told you who the performers are. Let me tell you where and when, and then we can move on.
All right.
It is when this coming Tuesday, the 5th of July, Lanford Wilson Day. I call it because the 5th of July was one of my favorite plays.
Yeah.
We open the doors at 6:30 p.m. at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art. Admission is free. We ask for a donation at the door so that we can buy our guest curator and our participants, our givers of work for free. Alms for the artists. We try to buy them dinner and cab fare and or whatever is necessary. Our goal is to break even for the night. And since it costs us money to do it, and we serve cider and stuff, and one occasion, Mercy Von Vlex. Wonderful cupcakes. I'm only finally returning the container for them tonight, as a matter of fact, to Ken. They know each other, Mercy and Ken. Be there. So it's this, again, Tuesday, July 5th, 6:30 p.m., free admission.
Bring your glasses.
We ask for donations, but we do not...
demand them.
We do not demand them at all. In fact, we demand that you have a good time. If you don't have the money, please don't slink by the front door. Say hi, and then say, I can't. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I'm not giving the donation. And say it nicely. We understand. I certainly understand because I probably can't necessarily afford the donation.
I smile every time I give the Metropolitan Museum $5 instead of the $15 or $30 they want.
Exactly. It's the same
kind of
that much. You got
I'm being nice because I like the flowers, even though they're paid for by a grand.
You know, you got a buck, you got 50 cents. Mm-hmm. We can use it all. But if you have nothing,
there's no reason you should deprive
then
yourself.
Please give that.
There we go.
Okay, so there you go. More information? You want more information? You want a copy of the email with the illustrations and all that?
Sure. Tell us more.
Yeah, just send me an email, jim@ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF.com. Okay. This is, by the way, mentioning of things, WBAI in New York City. The program is Hour of the Wolf. We're halfway through the program, and still we don't have a theme.
Hmm. Though themelessness could become the theme.
Ooh, there's a thought. You said I played my opening theme.
Well, that's true, sir. And there'll be a closing theme, so there'll be at least two themes with a more ephemeral one bracketed in between.
Exactly.
It's conceptual.
And my closing theme, of course, gives way to Lister.
There we go.
And there's the Owl of the Wolf theme from the trailer.
Well, that was the trailer. But we started... By the way, with music by Peter Schickele,
the professor.
Yes. Well, no. See, not the professor.
Not about his other identity.
The professor is just about P.D.Q. Bach.
Absolutely.
This was Peter Schickele's music
on the side,
as opposed to the music that he has discovered.
Yes. No, I forget the distinctions over time.
Yeah, which is all done. By the way, you're aware of how the music is done. How he figures out exactly when in the career of P.D.Q. Bach all that music is written. It's because Bach was such a heavy drinker.
Uh-huh.
And he went from town to town, and each town had different beer glasses. And he would put the beer glasses on the score. On the manuscript, on the music manuscript. And so Schickley is able to date the music by figuring out the circumference.
Where does he go on these dates?
And the methodology of figuring out, you know, the diameter is called the Steinway.
Whatever. So when he plays those glasses, it's a Steinway piano.
Exactly.
There we go.
Exactly. And he wrote that joke.
They recently solarized their roof.
He wrote that joke. Discovered that methodology in WBAI's music department while preparing for a concert that he was doing for us.
There we go. There we go. There were so many people who actually made a wonderful living, like Peter Schickley. Who did the opera?
Anna Russell.
Anna Russell.
Anna Russell is one of my favorites. And
brilliant.
I went
woman.
To a Schickley Peter Q. Bach concert, and he always had an opening act, and they were never announced. And one time,
it was Anna Russell, and then
it was Anna Russell doing her Ring Cycle.
Which is the all-time classic.
Remember the Ring.
Remember the Ring. Oh, remember Alveric. That was my favorite delivery of the line in it. But it's like there was this, and then there was Richard Armour who did in writing what they essentially did musically. But
he did history and he did
and
music,
Shakespeare
didn't he?
Yeah. And different things. But
1066 and all of that was, I think, his top book, right?
But I feel like there was this whole school of humor in the 70s, I guess really in the 70s, that essentially relied upon
60s and 70s.
60s
yeah.
and 70s that relied upon a certain classical education, of knowledge of certain areas of culture.
Well, people,
which we don't seem to be laughing anymore because I think people don't know the source material as much anymore. I mean, you could make jokes about the Ring Cycle,
but
I don't know if people get those anymore.
I think people are more serious today. I think they're deadly serious.
That's a horrifying thought.
We were talking before about the GL movie, the Green Lantern movie, and how most of these films, particularly the Marvel ones, with the possible exception of Iron Man, are for the most part humorless. Yeah. There may be jokes within them.
Yeah, but the new X-Men is very serious. It's relentlessly serious.
Yeah, whereas
it's good, but it's relentless.
In the first movie, they hired Joss Whedon
to make a few jokes,
to put a few jokes,
just to lighten up
there.
They could have brought him back for the new one, but technically, it predated the funnier movies with the clever Joss Whedon joke. So it being more serious actually makes
prequels,
sense.
Prequels. at any rate, I mean, there was a woman who worked at WBAI who has a free spirited. A public affairs television show today, and I guess it's a radio show as well. Laura Flanders, who's broadcasts are nowadays on CUNY, actually often right before Democracy Now's TV show is on there, and Laura Flanders is the daughter of Mike Flanders, as in Flanders and Swan, one of my favorite all-time satirical musical teams, and they often demanded a certain amount of knowledge of classics, doing words to Mozart's Horn Concerto, and or a song based on Newton's laws.
Yeah, well, shared culture.
The relativity rap. Yeah.
And Laura. And Laura. Now that's the new one. Laura. That's probably the modern.
I'm sure.
There's a rap show about Darwin, that's currently running off Broadway today.
There we go. That's a frightening.
It was reviewed in yesterday's New York Times.
So anyway,
it got good reviews too.
Well, that's good.
And
David Rothenberg had tickets for it when it was in preview.
I'm sure he did.
Lengthy rehearsals. Long evolution.
I think it's a one-man show. I'm not sure.
I don't remember.
But at any rate, it sounds interesting. Was this sort of Flanders and Swan, sort of the precursor? Yeah. They did at the drop of a hat, at the drop of another hat, and then the bestiary of Flanders and Swan. Donald Swan did an opera based on Perelandra by C.S. Lewis.
Wow.
In a whole opera, science fiction opera. And interesting people. But the thing is that, as I recall talking to Laura Flanders, maybe it was that she was simply tired of the topic. She, being a very serious, not totally serious, but I guess, looking to be taken seriously as a journalist, she sort of like put the fact that her father was a well-known satirist and comic at a distance. And I was disappointed, being a huge fan.
Well, a lot of times you have to push something aside in order to create accept something that's different. And then once you're comfortable in whatever that difference is...
But I blame society, damn it. I maintain, maybe here's a theme.
Yeah.
We could take phone calls on
the
it
fall
or whatever.
Of society?
I think that people are just too damn serious. I think that, you know, Peter Parker does not have to be totally forlorn and loveless. I think that Judd Apatow movies on the one end.
Twilight is relentlessly humorless as well.
Yeah, that's interesting
because these Spider-Man comics, he was always wisecracking.
Oh, always.
That's right.
But only as Spider-Man. Local. But only as Spider-Man. Peter was humorless, but Spider-Man was quite the witch. Peter? I don't remember Peter being
with
that funny.
With his aunt?
Yeah, well, that was playful banter.
Yeah, so it was playful banter.
Spider-Man was sharp.
But the point is it was playful banter. It wasn't deadly serious aunt.
No, I'll agree with that.
But what happened is
Spider-Man had the sense of humor.
I think when people review things, they key in on certain aspects of whatever it is. And then people key in on what other people keyed in on, and then all of a sudden they forget the variety. So they forget that there was humor in Spider-Man. And because all they talk about is the angst and
the adolescent
teenagers have angst, and that was never in comics before ever, which is crap.
But teenagers also had smart mouths, and that was never in comics before either.
But take a look at the movie.
But again, all of that was in comics before. It's just that Stan Lee was very, very, very good at it.
Yeah, exactly.
And he synthesized what a lot of other people have done in a much better way.
Yeah, exactly.
But people tended to forget that there was fun involved.
You had comedy in your Spider-Man TV show, right, Terrence?
Yes. I was just thinking back.
There was wit in it anyway.
No, John definitely got humor in there. His season had some good laughs in it.
But at least that's Spider-Man.
It was a bit of a reboot of the Spider-Man thing. It was a little more...
But, of course, at that time, grittier. He wasn't falling down from Broadway stages.
Yeah.
Well, I have, by the way, I hope everybody on the radio can see that I have my flying superhero monkey. Right? He's wearing a cape and everything.
And
when he falls, okay? And he's got extendable arms
so that you can
fire him into the air.
Oh, geez.
And that's weird enough. And when he falls, are you ready? It is the most pathetic sound. The most pathetic sound.
It sounds like Cheetah being whipped
by
Tarzan.
if sometime in the future,
or something else that I won't say on air.
You know, Buffy's going to be known as, you know, women kick ass, and that's where really got everything started, and all the humor is going to be forgotten.
Well, Buffy was one of the funniest shows.
Yes, but after the fact, he's saying. It will be remembered only as
the relentless seriousness. We're going to see with a new movie, right? They're remaking Buffy, unfortunately, without Joss Whedon, who...
Oh, really?
He turned it down.
Well, he has
He's
that
doing
right.
the Avengers. He's doing the Avengers.
But why are we redoing Buffy? I mean, what? How many years was the series on? Is there a square inch of story they didn't cover?
Because if you were the producer who owned the property to begin with...
And you suddenly needed a new country home.
The Kazooies, K-U-Z-U-I. Yeah. These are the people who created and own Buffy. They made the movie with Joss Whedon as the writer. I don't remember who directed it.
Joss wrote the original.
He wrote it. It didn't do that well.
No,
They were able to sell it as a TV series. The TV series did very well. Where else do they go? They have wanted.
I'm sorry. They go where they set up to go to at the end of the damn series, which is to the spinoff Slayer School, which was a brilliant setup.
It was.
It never went anywhere.
I've always been waiting for Faith
the Vampire
Slayer.
Thank you. Why are we remaking the original movie
when they could extend it into something so much larger?
But is it going to be a remake?
It'll be or a reboot. I hate the term.
Really? It's a remake.
A reboot only starts it up
basically
again clean.
They figured out that the marketing that they want to do is based on Buffy itself. They wanted nobody to write it and produce it except Joss Whedon.
And he said no.
And he said no. Well, now, everybody's like going, how dare you? And the answer is it's not that they dare. They want to do it, but he's busy.
Well, but the other thing is, I mean, if I were Joss, I should be so lucky. I mean, how it's like going back to the wife who like died quietly in her sleep 10 years ago and digging her up and you know, going back.
No, I think it's continuing.
But continuing a relationship.
Okay, with all...
But not if you go back to when you met her.
And you're rewriting the introduction.
Yes,
it's one. If they had said to him, come back in.
Right, and do season 9.
And do what you want.
With all he would be there. Because
season 8 was done in comics, and why couldn't he do season 9 as a movie?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But if you're going back to the beginning, I'm going to re-meet my wife now.
With all due respect, since Serenity,
yes.
What has Joss Whedon done that's been major?
I just watched something the other day that had his name on it that surprised the hell out of me. What was it?
And he's done Dr. Horrible.
Which was actually a lot more fun than I thought it would be.
But that was a throwaway project done during the writer's strike.
That's fun with your friends. I mean, that wasn't anything real.
Exactly.
But there was something...
He's done a lot of comic books, but I guess that's not...
No, but there was something else. There was something I saw the other day.
Or movies.
A movie that he was on. What was it? Damn it.
I mean, I'm sure that he's getting, you know, I'm sure he's doing a lot of uncredited work on
Well,
film.
Technically, I mean, he's
I think he should bring the
enough.
Dance of Shame to
I'm not sure whether or not he had anything to do with Toy Story 3. He wrote 1 and 2, of course. Hmm. People don't remember that. Why don't they remember that Joss Whedon wrote Toy Story?
I don't remember that at all.
Absolutely.
I mean, he's
done a lot of really good stuff.
No.
And he's one of the biggest, you know, unnamed, as it, you know, script doctors in Hollywood. They run things for, like, you know, a patch-up.
So he's picked up where William Goldman left off, basically.
Yeah.
Because Goldman was rewriting
stuff.
John
Sayles used to be
a script doctor. A lot of brilliant writers. Really good.
It's a great way to make money so you can do the projects you care about.
Yeah, Elaine May was doing that for years uncredited. You know,
yeah, exactly.
A lot of great writers who are doing that.
Mike Nichols probably also. Nichols and me. But one way or the other, I thought that Serenity was a wonderful movie.
I loved the movie. I actually liked the movie better than the series.
Me too.
Sure.
The series was kind of slow, and it's like, I'm through the westerns in space. But Serenity wrapped it all up so nicely.
I liked the series. I thought the movie was a very upscale working of the series. I'm the one who liked Dollhouse. I thought Dollhouse.
I like Dollhouse a lot. It made me uncomfortable as hell.
Which is a good thing.
I mean, it's
that
like,
was the intent.
One of the definitions of art is it makes you uncomfortable, makes you think about it. And man,
Dollhouse really got under your skin.
Oh, it was. See, I mean, it was captivating. I mean, it was because I think we are really close to that technology. We may even be there. I mean, we are so. I think we're so close to being able to identify brainwaves and how the brain works and recreating things and downloading.
Well, and that's all a very old story going back to the 40s and all that. But the way Whedon did that, the way that he added it to our sexual identity.
Well, modern politics. Sure. He did modern politics.
Absolutely in modern politics. But
that's what made it so scary.
But
because it was so modern.
But the thing that worked so well is, I don't know why, I was watching this thing and people are saying, oh, it's just, you know, blah, blah, blah of the week. And I said, no, it isn't. There's an arc. And if you watch from the episode, it moved very slowly. That's true.
Well,
but if you were looking for the arc and then in episode like 6, 7, or 8, I don't remember which.
Well, they explain what's actually going on?
They don't exactly explain it. What they do is they take 4 different storylines, each one of which has been a separate arc.
Uh-huh.
And we've discovered that this one character, the guy who was in there originally, this Russian guy, is actually, you know, we thought was a person, is a doll himself.
Right.
And all this sophisticated stuff. They did 4 completely distinct stories, each one in a different act, separated by the commercials, with a prelude that opened them all together and a closer that ended them all together. And at that point, my jaw had dropped. I think it is one of Whedon's best scripts ever, which is saying a lot for a person
who's written some amazing scripts.
And the way he managed to synthesize that. The problem, and then, of course, at the end of the first season, there was Epitaph, which was never broadcast. You know, where you take the whole thing into the far, far future.
Let's see.
After this,
yeah,
so
I saw it all on DVD.
That's right. Because, that's the way to do it.
Yeah, I tried to watch it on TV, and one in my life just. I can't sit and watch something.
Right.
And also, you can't come in the middle of it.
No. Well, that was the problem that I had.
So I had no idea that that wasn't broadcast originally until I watched the commentaries and found out.
And then you realize that half of the people had no idea what the series was about because typically the station, shall we say, Fox, didn't broadcast it.
Well, part of the problem is it was at an odd time, so I kept missing it. So I caught one or two early
But it was in a weird
time. Yeah,
and then I sort of skipped it, and then I caught an episode, and I don't know which episode it is, but it was the one where they sort of explain, look, you may think you don't want to be here and we're manipulating you, but you're here because you wanted to be here because you wanted to forget something so awful in your life that this is the only way to get out of it. And that was the first episode that grabbed my attention. Because they covered, I think, about 3-4 different characters. They find out what their reality is, and then it's building up to her.
I mean, between the two seasons.
But then I got into work again. I couldn't go back to it. But that was fascinating.
I mean, it's really worth seeing it the way that Ken saw it. That's the way to watch the series, like the same way it is to watch Doctor
Who.
Thank
you, Sidney Smith, because he lent me the DVD.
Oh, by the way, very, very important listeners, very, very important listeners, Friday, July 8th, one word, Torchwood.
Miracle Day.
Don't get cable, so.
Miracle Day.
What day is it?
July 8th, a week from Friday. A week from Friday.
I'm gonna set my DVR.
Miracle Day. I don't know how many episodes Torchwood is.
We don't know how many episodes like or how depressing or scarred will be.
But
because Children of Earth, I still.
Oh, Children of Earth
weep
was
over.
Genius.
It was brilliant.
I can't even discuss it because I don't want to spoil it for anybody who hasn't seen it. They killed that guy off gratuitously. This is a Whedon problem.
Well, yeah. And there were a lot of reasons I was sorry to see him go, but not the least of which was he hadn't done a nude scene yet. But at any rate, one can dream.
But it's Torchwood. He could come back tomorrow.
But as some dead zombie.
Nobody. Yeah. Well, who knows? I mean,
play with time, you can do all kinds of killer things.
So when is Torchwood again? July 10th?
8th. Friday, July 8th, you can go back, exactly, Ken, you can go back in time, you can move forward in time, one of the episodes is called They Keep Killing Susie.
That was great. Okay, so I caught, the last season, and I had this crash and burn, I just wanted to watch comforting things, so I watched all of the Doctor Who on Netflix.
Comforting things, like Torchwood, yeah.
Well, but I started with Doctor Who, because... Instant, automatic conflict resolution.
Especially under the new regime,
guaranteed good conflict resolution, no matter how scary it gets. Yes.
Moffat is a wuss.
it's comforting fair. And
with the exception of the end of Jekyll.
I haven't seen that. I haven't watched all the way through yet. Don't say anything about that. I haven't seen that.
I will tell you this. But, best Gina Bellman moments ever. Forget Leverage. Coupling. Okay?
Oh, okay.
And she's also also the female star of Leverage in American television.
Oh, I have to watch
and
that.
And she is Mrs. Jekyll in Jekyll, directed by
Stephen Moffat.
I saw
the first
Moffat.
Two. I haven't watched the rest of them.
Oh. Well, you see, it starts episode 3.
See, that's the thing. But the first two were like, eh. So also the mysterious organization started rising up in the background.
Yeah, that was a problem.
It started seeming like pie and all these other things.
It ends very poorly because they canceled the show and told him between episodes 5 and 6. So episode 6 sort of like just ends badly and peters out. But I got to tell you, episodes 3 and 4 at least
I'll go back to those.
Available on your Netflix.
It's live notes on my live stack.
Is so... well worth watching. Mm. And, you know, using some of the cast of Coupling, which is also
a
Stephen
Moffat
show.
Yeah.
I never even knew there was a show called Jekyll, so.
Oh, it's great fun. Well, so after I watched all the Doctor Who's, I started catching up on Torchwood. And my God, when I went back, it was like even darker, more depressing than I remember. I loved the Keep Killing Jane one was like, oh my God. And she just didn't quite die. There are repercussions of her for at least the next two or three episodes. So.
Yeah. Sort of I mean, I think people would be hard, you know, talking about the moroseness of so much entertainment today. Torchwood has some very, very funny moments.
Yeah.
But at
the end, everybody dies, but two characters, one of whom is immortal. I mean, it was sort of sad by the last episode.
And he's not happy about being
alive. He's not happy about being alive at that point. And so, I mean, it was really sort of like at the end, it was like, God, well, Gwen, I hope you get good therapy afterwards because it was just so depressing. But brilliant. I mean,
you know what
it.
Still keeps what still for me keeps the tension between comedy and fright and moroseness being human, the British version.
Yeah.
Does a the American still have my issues. And the problem is you watch the American version and the American version talk about morose, there isn't one light-hearted line entire series.
See the American
Well let's go back then.
Save yourself.
So maybe
actually it's not that bad.
The issue is not that the world is humorless. It's that America's lost its sense of humor. It's that we are so freaked out
American
by no longer
culture,
being
American
the number one
culture.
World power that we're like retreating into a fetal ball and looking at the world as dark and grim because we don't rule it anymore. Is that what's happening?
Otherwise, where else would you sell or give away a stuffed superhero monkey who sounds like... And he only makes that noise when
if
he
you
falls
pound him
the
really
way,
hard.
It has to land
on
its
the belly.
Body.
Belly
it
flop.
It has to do a belly,
belly
flop.
Belly flop right there.
I showed this to Rick Bowes, my guest last week. Yes. And Richard Bowes is an expert on toys. He has seen
that's
them
right,
all.
That's right.
He was astonished by
He'd
this
He'd never
thing.
Seen such a thing.
Maybe. No, I've never seen such a thing either. This is a tchotchke from computer
age.
Trade show.
I could tell by the logo on the cape that he had some sort of affiliation.
Yeah. T-Mobile.
Well, I
it's a T-Mobile.
I wasn't going to say it aloud.
It's a T-Mobile monkey.
I wasn't going to say it aloud.
Okay.
But.
And if you have a T-Mobile monkey on your back, well.
Well, I have a Verizon monkey on my back. And
yeah, that'd be an interesting theme for discussion about why are Americans so humorless in our
Well, that's what I'm
I think it's the fall of the empire.
The popular culture reflects...
Absolutely. I always, I mean, horror movies always reflect the fears of the age. And that was actually one of the things I found fascinating. With that whole huge craze over remaking all these Japanese and Korean horror films about ghosts and vengeance, I started looking at that in that exact context.
And the Korean films also.
Well, that's what I said. Japanese and Korean.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
J-movies, but they were mostly Korean. I mean, The Grudge, most of these things were really coming out of Korea. But. What they were basically all about. But they got enormously popular to the point they started remaking all of them for the American market. And I was looking at that in that context. What is this saying about where we are right now? Because I remembered in the 80s when Halloween and those movies came out, you know, we analyzed what's it. And I looked at all these movies, and the thing that they all had in common was the sins of someone coming back to haunt them. We've done terrible things either for our own self-interest or out of ignorance. And now we're paying the consequences. And I started looking at American foreign policy and American economic policy and all these things. And
environmental
that,
policy.
That is the big fear.
Ecological
right now,
disaster that ecological, we have wreaked upon ourselves.
Yes, and when you
and
look at it.
And we're trying to pretend that we haven't. That the disaster hasn't really happened.
And the biggest fear we have right now is it's going to come back to bite us. Yes, Cloverfield, even. You look at Cloverfield, it's like all they're doing is a bunch of rich yuppies running on screen. Why is this happening
to us? Cloverfield is just Godzilla, and Godzilla is...
It's Godzilla, but it's Godzilla with a very specific backstory that went beyond the film about industrial waste and all this crap. I mean, you know, being dumped in Japan off the waters that create this monster, you know, in essence, and conspiracy and all that sort of thing. But essentially the whole movie...
In other words, J.J. Abrams.
In other words, J.J. Abrams. But the whole movie is essentially about people saying, why me? I'm not responsible. It's not my fault. Why is this happening to me? And I think that's what a lot of us feel in this country. I mean, we're dealing with the consequences of the last couple of generations. And the big thing is like, what do you mean the world is collapsing now? I mean, again, the apocalyptic crap is rising like crazy. Yeah. The guy with the garden that was at the end of the world on the 21st that never happened. Technically, for many of his followers, the world did end because they gave everything away. But in the larger sense, no.
Except they're still in business.
And which I find amazing.
As are Jehovah's Witnesses.
As is every other apocalyptic cult. I mean, because anytime the world doesn't end, they come with an excuse
for it. Some of them killed themselves.
Some of them did. But the survivors then came up with an excuse for the
life. They're not still in business.
Vodka and Milltowns.
I know one group that said that, well, the world did end the day they said it ended, and this is now hell. It went from being the world to being hell overnight, and nobody, noticed the difference.
Well, a lot of people sort of felt it was hell a little while ago, But it's like my thing was that the world actually ended the first time anyone said it. It just takes a while to run down. It's entropy. I mean, it's not like you can stop it like that. It takes
like
a while.
It's like the tipping point in global warming.
Exactly. Well, so it's crumbling. I mean, it's not like it's been improving for the last 50 years.
I have every intention of producing a radio documentary.
On the collapse of civilization?
On Armageddon's.
Well, there we go. Absolutely.
What year will I broadcast this? Duh. 2012.
Absolutely. Yeah, right. No, but it's
Armageddon out of here.
But we had that conversation, I think, in the cab on the way back.
I think
to
I will
Mercy.
Title it that.
And
Armageddon out of here.
Let's call it Armageddon out of here. Damn, just before I got it out of my mouth. There we go.
And the...
I want the T-shirt concession.
And the Joe Cumo of WBAI in the 80s did a...